Okay, anybody need an outline? There are two outlines going around. Well, actually, there's only one. It's on both sides. You want the one on the side that says marriage. And then each of the married couples got something that I'll email the rest of you, just some background quotes that I might or might not use. How do we get into this topic? We've been studying the book of Ephesians. We came to kind of a hallmark of how a body of believers should interact with each other, where Paul instructed them to submit themselves to one another in the fear of God. And then, for those of you who are with us in the book of Ephesians, we saw how God is trying to build the body of believers together into a unit, a unified group of people, so that they're a temple that he can dwell in. And that's how you can see the glory of God today, because the Old Testament temple is gone. So we have the New Testament temple, it's the body of believers. And then I skipped over the sections that related to three kinds of relationships to kind of finish up the way that Satan tries to disrupt that unity through lies. The section that I skipped over dealt with three hierarchical relationships that are kind of exceptions to this mutual submission principle. Wives, husbands, children, parents, slaves, masters. And in these three kinds of relationships, you can't really flip them. God has assigned certain roles and responsibilities to the individuals. There's an outline on the website, some of you have it, some of you probably have it tacked up in your cubicles, called the S word on submission, and it kind of deals with the fact that submission's not a bad idea. Jesus submits to the Father, and it has nothing to do with worth or value, it just has to do with structurally the way things work out. So I commend that to you. I can answer some questions on it if you want. The section that follows in Ephesians 5:22 has basically two commands. The ones addressed to wives are, you should submit to your husband and respect him. And the one addressed to husbands, we basically just get one because we can't count that high, is we need to love our wives. And that means we do what's in their best interest. So it's neither person can take advantage of the other. The husbands have to basically be making all their decisions based on what is in their wife's best interest. And she just can't live surely for her own interest because she has responsibilities of honoring and respecting her husband as well. So why am I talking about marriage in a mixed group? Well, the scriptures do. And couples are not the only people who need to understand marriage, because marriage is just a relationship. And the best preparation for a good marriage is good relationships with other people, particularly close, transparent, accountable relationships, just like we talk about in Time of Your Life. Marriage is just a goal. It's an objective that can be worked towards, it can be built, or it can be torn down. Depending on how much effort and how much you want to make the thing work, you can have either a good one or a bad one. Most people have bad ones. Most of you know the statistic that half of the people who get married get divorced. Of the couples that manage to stay together 20 years, 6 out of 100 would say they're happy. 6 out of 100. So I tell my classes, we kind of talk about that. Somehow I work it into Western Civ.
Well, you need to keep the civilization going.
Right, we do need to keep the civilization. Well, the way I work it in is in terms of the pursuit of happiness, which was a big Greek philosophical endeavor. When you look at what actually makes people happy, marriages normally show up on the list of people who consider themselves happy. So that's kind of how I get into it, as well as keeping the civilization going. Yet 6 out of 100 who've managed to stay together for 20 years consider themselves happy. So you have to realize, wow, the odds are highly, highly, highly stacked against me having a good relationship, a happy relationship, much less a great or magnificent marriage. One of my favorite sites, and I'll actually tell you a little bit more about it when we go through it, is called mentalhealth.net. It's not done by a believer. It's done by a very, very brilliant INTJ who has summarized thousands of studies on various psychological and sociological trends. And one study, which I think I might even have given some of the couples on, quotes a guy who studied 13,000 marriages. And he studied 13,000 marriages. And most of you are aware of your marriage, maybe your parents' relationship, maybe that of a friend, and you kind of build your life based on this really, really sketchy sample of information. 13,000 marriages. Of those, he said, less than 25% are happy. He said 50% of them have no chance at happiness unless they have some really serious and intensive counseling. Think about that. There's 25% who might, with a little bit of effort, stumble on the right path, but over half the population of the half that manage to stay married actually gets, you know, there. So why is marriage in such a bad shape? Well, the problem is marriage is made up of people, and people are imperfect. And when you have just one person living by themselves, their imperfections can kind of be hidden. When you have two people theoretically blending their lives together, you have multiplied misery. You know, marriage can even give. Ground rules, no nudging, no elbows. Otherwise, we'll have to separate the spouses. But, you know, if you take one person who is who basically fundamentally is unhappy with themselves, and you know, then put them with another person that's unhappy with themselves, you know, you've just multiplied the potential for misery. And then, to really finish it off and sound the death knell, you throw in these group of critters called kids. Additional self-centered beings, imperfect, looking to get their needs met, and you put them into this thing called the family, and it's amazing that any of them are still left around, and they haven't all self-destructed. Although a lot of them, you know, they're kind of like these bombed out buildings, there's just the outside shell and there's nothing on top, nothing inside, nothing below, it's just, you know, the outside structure. So, the good news is, it's not that difficult to have a good relationship. It's a little more difficult to have a great relationship, but a good relationship can happen. And I'll be giving you reasons why that can happen, why you can do to prevent it from happening as we go through this. I was probably only going to cover top three points on this, and maybe we can do some others in some other time. But I think it's fair to kind of ask yourself whenever you're looking at how to make something work, how does it not work? And I have an interesting little quote here. It's interesting. I wanted to find out what were the common causes of marriages breaking up. And I've been searching for this for years. And every time I come upon a list, I find similar things, but everybody's got a different list. So there's just so many ways you can do this wrong, but there are only a few ways you can actually do it right. Causes of marriage failures, according to the American Association of Matrimonial Lawyers. So these are the guys who get rich off other people's problems. The number one cause is poor communication, and that seems to be uniform. Now, communication means to have in common. Common with. Common is with. Commune, the with thing. So self-centered people have a really hard time communicating or having something in common with anyone else. And you'll see why we tend to hide and hurl and deceive ourselves about the reality, which makes us bad communicators in a few minutes. Financial problems. Financial problems are really just a lightning rod. It's something that's nice. It's quantifiable. It gives you something to holler and fuss about, although it does cause a break. A lack of commitment to marriage is the next one. But by the way, you don't have to take any of these down because I'll email you this. Some of you already have it when I did the intimacy stuff. Commitment to be a live happily ever after is the key ingredient. If you look at the sheet I gave you right at the bottom, the E, expect to triumph through trials, cherishing commitment, right, and it's on the marriage one, right at the bottom. That is, put a little star by that because I might not get back to it, but that is the key. If you're committed to something, you succeed at something. It doesn't matter if it's a job, planting a tree, having a relationship, commitment is always the key to success. And if the couples, I mean, there's always going to be stuff that causes couples to want to throw in the towel. But commitment to making things work makes it so they don't do that. Dramatic change in priorities, infidelity, failed expectations, unmet needs, addiction, substance abuse, other kinds of abuse, lack of conflict resolution skills are all secondary kind of causes. So we'll talk about those if there's time and if you're interested.
I think they need for freedom. I think that's can be very tough. Somebody used to have their own freedom. They used to do everything on their own, and then they got to do it somebody else. It's a very big struggle.
That's true, right? And basically, that independence is the essence of sin. It's, you want to do your own thing, and in order to enjoy the benefits of anything, you have to give up something. If you want to enjoy the benefits of eating in a good restaurant, what do you have to do? You got to give up some money and the option of eating somewhere else. It's just the way life works. You want to succeed in a job, you got to give up doing some other stuff. You know, anything you want to succeed at requires a cost. There's nothing that's free in this world. Everything has a price tag attached to it, except for salvation. But you do have to give up your pride in order to admit you need being saved. So even that one has it. So I titled this marriage feast or famine, because it can be a feast, although most people are living on a fast food diet that's slowly killing them. We saw Super Size Me this week. So disadvantages of a fast food diet. Well, you know, that's the same thing. People put all the wrong things into their marriage, and as a result, they get a marriage that's, you know, laden with all the stuff that's toxic. So let's take a look at bad objective for marriage, and then we'll look at good objective. This comes out of toil. The philosophy behind toil is to lead a sound-minded life. The big idea behind Titus, the one command that was addressed to every single group in the church, marrieds and singles and everything, was to live sound-mindedly. And that meant to have your mind controlled by objectives rather than emotions. It's real, real simple. And that was the paragon of Greek virtue, was you lived controlled by objectives. Rick Warren kind of captures some of that in The Purpose-Driven Life, and obviously that was a driving, this idea of being sound-minded was a driving force behind toil. The five areas of toil are work and career, relationships, personal life, spiritual life, and ministry. Under relationships, you have numerous ones, and this is where this one fits in. It's a kind of relationship that you have. And actually, it's no different from any other relationship, except for the sex part. In one sense, it's just a friendship. Friendships develop just like that. And that's why when I did it in toil, when we had more time to do toil, I would talk about friendships first. And that's why on the flip side of your sheet, when I talk about intimacy, I talk about friendships there. And I'll eventually get there. But first, let's look at the bad objective. Bad objective for any relationship is to get my needs met for whatever through someone else. And that's what most people think about when they think about relationships. How do I get my needs met through this person? What can this person do for me? What can I get out of this person? And ultimately, that's using the other person. Well, when you start moving into marriage, it's the same thing. A bad objective, which is what most people have, is to get their needs met through their spouse and then kids. You know, there's the stereotypical, I won't mention the ethnic or religious group, mother-in-law, who's always talking about her kids or her grandkids, and, you know, it's like, worth by proxy, she gets her worth and value based on the fact that the kids are doing well. That person is getting their needs for significance met through the fact that someone else is doing well. You know, normally parents like that get kids who succeed in spite of the parents, but it's another story. So to get my needs for security, significance, worth, pleasure, or companionship met through someone else. Now it's true God does use another person to meet some of your needs, but he's the one who's using it, not you. If you go through into any kind of relationship expecting, oh great, this person's going to meet all my needs and have me live happily ever after, you will be one of those statistics. You actually won't get into the 50% that manage to endure to be miserable. You will separate and be miserable. Stop right there. Flip it over on this page and... two sermons that I did that directly relate to this is Can God Meet Emotional Needs and the friendship one. The Can God Meet Emotional Needs sermon struck a very resonant chord in numerous people over the years. And, you know, when people get turned on to this truth, you know, all the lights go on and, you know, they suddenly become very functional. One of the things that I don't hear much feedback on is the friendship one, which means people even haven't looked at it or they just don't have good friendships. But marriage is born out of a good friendship, and it's really good to work on developing good friendships with those that you practice on people that you don't have to live with for the rest of your life. You single folks, you know, make your mistakes now, scar someone else up, because you don't want to have to scar up and live with this thing that you've kind of ruined. It's like, you know, that's kind of a good thing. But in the emotional needs thing, you can kind of read those on your own, A and B in particular. C is the one I wanted to get to. Personal needs are intimacy with God. These are needs that we have. Fellowship with other people and self-worth. Feeling of being cared for, loved, accepted, a lifestyle that makes an impact on others. Our self-worth is enhanced to the extent that these qualities define our lives. So we're looking for that stuff. It's, everybody wants those things. But the problem is we look to other people to meet those needs. Now, I am a finite being. I am an imperfect finite being. The strange thing about being a finite being is that I can have infinite needs, or at least needs that are going to wear out any other finite being. So, how do I, as a finite being surrounded by imperfect finite beings, get my needs met? I get them met by an infinite being. And under Roman numeral 2, it's on the right-hand column. Looking to another finite, fallible person to meet my needs is futile, it's temporary at best. Using rather than loving that person, stunting my growth. And people start, you know, this is a major rocket booster to their spiritual and emotional development, just when they realize that God meets my needs. And if you haven't figured out how to have God meet your needs and your emotional needs, you really haven't developed much of a relationship with God, and that'd be a good thing to kind of work on. We could talk about that, but I don't want to spend a sermon doing that. So, let's go back to bad objective, better objective. A better objective in marriage is to profitably reflect the unity, love, and wisdom of God. Just imagine a guy getting down on one knee, opening up a little box and said, "Will you profitably reflect the unity, love, and wisdom of God with me forever and ever?" Yeah, that's not going to do it. However, if you want to continue the fairy tale romance kind of thing, that really has to be the objective. Now, if you're reflecting the love, unity, and wisdom of God, that means you're experiencing, modeling, giving, and receiving love like God does. You're involved in this intimacy and union that is very God-like. And you're also involved in living the best possible way in wisdom. It's actually not as unromantic as it sounds, because it is the way to live happily ever after. What happens instead is people go into the relationship thinking, I'm kind of attracted to this person. They look really great, and they turn me on. They can do wonderful things for me. So I want to spend time with them, and I'll marry them. All right, then what happens is after some of the initial kisses wear off, he discovers that she isn't the beautiful princess, she's really the old hag. And she discovers that this prince really has turned into a frog that burps. And, you know, it's like, okay, now we're stuck, and how do we make the best of this, you know, horror tale that we've wound up with? All right, so, you want to get one of these better objectives, and kind of elaborate on unity, love, and wisdom. You can meditate on that. It'll probably do you more good than me explaining it, but if you can't figure it out, I'll talk to you. I'll give you some more on it later. So the pieces that you need for a marriage relationship to put it together and make it work and build a house that you want to live in, follow the acrostic marriage. So I took all the things that I found in the scriptures and outside scripture that go into making a good relationship, and I did my crunching and organizing as INTPs tend to do, and this is what I came up with. I kind of came up with most of this before I got married, because I didn't want to be married. I definitely didn't want to have kids. I saw how much misery marriage caused in my parents' life, and said, there's no way I would ever subject myself to that. I remember when I was about 30, 35 or so, my dad saying to me, "Yeah, sorry, I really couldn't be there for you when you're growing up." He used to travel. He said, "I traveled 200 days a year because the alternative was being home with your mother." So, yeah, you can kind of imagine going, you know, this was, it was not something I wanted to go into without knowing every possible angle to possibly make this thing work. And it was the same thing with kids. I kind of, as soon as I started studying marriage, I realized, oh, kids are really a bad stress on this. People would say, "Oh, we had a good relationship until the kids came along." And, I talked with my mom about the relationship. "Oh, it was pretty good until the kids came along." So I said, I don't want kids either. But I realized there's a way to do it right what I've done in my, what I do in my Western Civ course, is I say truth is that which best explains all the fact. Truth accurately reflects reality. How do you find truth? It's at the convergence of three things. Revelation, authenticated revelation, God has said, reason, and reality. And when those three things line up, you got a pretty good grip on truth and what really, really works. One of the statistics I came across in selfhelp.net, or mentalhelp.net, was 40% of women who are being treated for major depression have their depression as a result of their marriage. And so there's a little clicky thing, whatever they call it, link to on depression. So I went to see what this guy's summary was on depression. And he said, so we reviewed the 16 major theories of depression. Now, the reason I like selfhelp.net is it gives me a totally secular view of what's out there in the world. It doesn't give me everything that's integrated, but it gives me the fruits of all these studies and various ideas. I take that, I take revelation in terms of what God has said, and I use reason to kind of say, all right, which of these things really are most important, which work? And it was going through a process like that I kind of came up with the stuff that's on this sheet. Sometimes revelation needs to be tempered by reason, not because the revelation is wrong, but our understanding of it is inaccurate. So you know, you kind of want to be firing on all cylinders of revelation, reason, and then see what actually works in reality before you have this thing that works well. So to use the metaphor of building a great relationship, and this would work in all relationships, but particularly in a marriage relationship, I'd like to compare two different types of furniture. Some of you have been to our house and noticed that we have some really old furniture. We bought it old. It's antiques. It's designed to be old. And there's some of these drawers that we open and close every single day, just like someone's been doing for hundreds of years, and the things are as good as the first day they were made. They have a dovetail joint. There's other stuff that we kind of picked up here and there, or was given to us, that came from, you know, IKEA, door store, or other places, that falls apart usually within a year. You know, the drawer, you pull in the drawer and all of a sudden it comes out in your hand. What's the difference between those two? One was done with a dovetail bond. Things were bonded together with a dovetail joint. And the others were slapped together with what's called a butt joint. You take two pieces of wood, you butt them together, and you put some glue in between to hold it, and then you throw a couple nails in so it won't fall apart until it gets out the door, and then you ship it. Well, over time, that glue loosens and dries out. And then all you have left holding it is these kind of external nails, and over time, with the stresses on it, they loosen, and then the thing falls apart. And that is so much like so many relationships. There's an emotional attraction, the emotional glue. Two people get attracted to each other, and they're both thinking, this person will meet all my needs. This is my dream spouse. They will make me live happily ever after. They will support me in a style to which I am not accustomed. You know, they will do all this for me. And the other person is equally deceived, thinking, oh, this person will meet my every dream and fantasy. And there's this emotional attachment, and there's this bead of glue that gets laid down, the two pieces of wood get slapped together. They walk down an aisle somewhere and say, I do, and a couple nails get banged into the joint, and lo and behold, we have a made in USA marriage. You know, there it is. And then the stresses come along. You know, there's the change in job responsibilities, financial pressures, in-law pressures. Then, you know, they're not around as much. They stop doing the things they used to do. The glue kind of starts drying out. Then, and we'll talk about the whole disillusionment bit in a few minutes. They get disillusioned, and guess what? The emotional glue is dried up. And you just have those little nails of I do, holding the thing together. And after a while, you say, you know, really, I'd be so much happier apart from this relationship than I am with this relationship. And as America has gotten increasing easily divorce rate, we used to have a society that kind of frowned on divorce, and now it's celebrated because it frees you to do your own thing. Boom, the marriages. People don't even work on the marriages anymore, and it's just like one huge junkyard of ruined, failed marriages, or to continue the metaphor of broken drawers. On the other hand, the furniture that's lasting for centuries is kind that if you pull open the drawer and look at the side of it, it has a dovetail joint. And since I used to have it would love to have time to have a hobby of making furniture like that, and used to have, and still love to look at a good piece of furniture. I'll tell you how you make a dovetail joint. You take two pieces of wood, and you make sure they match. You cut them, you trim them, you sand them, you just put them through a planer. So you get these two perfectly smooth pieces of wood. There are no imperfections in the wood. They are, all the rough edges have been knocked off them. And if you ever look at poorly made furniture, you'll see the wood really didn't match, the glue was holding it together. And that's why when I talked about developing your character, that's getting all those rough edges knocked off, getting rid of the things that, you know, other people are going to find offensive, getting rid of the self-centeredness, getting rid of all the stuff I'm going to talk about a little later. So you now are perfectly ready to be joined to another. But wait, there's more. What happens in a dovetail joint is you don't just slap those two pieces of wood together. You then take this perfectly good piece of wood and you cut into it a notch, and then you cut another notch, and another notch, and another notch, and you take things out of that piece of wood that are perfectly wonderful. Why? Because you've done the same thing to the other piece of wood, and then when you've taken equal pieces out of each one, the two fit together and the dovetail joint locks in. And the nice thing about a dovetail joint is when you put a stress on it, it becomes stronger. The very first piece of furniture, once I learned how to make dovetail joints, the first thing I made was this little step stool. I just like putting four pieces of wood together to see if I could do the thing. And we have abused that thing. We have stood on it. We have jumped on it. The kids used to play on it. We've used it to hold up piano. You know, it's just like it's used for everything. And there's no glue in it, but the thing still holds together. It's amazing because when the stresses come, it holds the thing tighter together. If you haven't made the equation to a marriage relationship yet, there are sometimes perfectly good things that need to be cut out of your life in order to more closely mesh with another person. Which means you have to get into the idea of something we talked about last week, yielding your rights. Instead of fighting with God of, oh, why are you going to take that out of my life? I need that. That's mine. You let things come out of your life so, and you're more amenable to the master craftsman shaping you so you can match together with the other piece of wood that he's planning on joining you with. So you have a choice. You can mastercraft a dovetailed bond or a mishmash of butt joint. On the emotional glue and nail versus straighten, trim, smooth, cut to mesh, and fit together. Those who are really good at sanctifying themselves and becoming more like Christ will obviously have a much better relationship. Just think, two other-centered people who are thankful and proactive and responsive to the Spirit of God, living together, doing things for each other, it's bliss. It's not the opposite of regular marriage where you have other-centered people just looking for what they can get, totally cutting off the Spirit of God in their life, and in one sense very passive about doing anything for the benefit of anyone else. The second task, or way you have to think about this, actually it's like a task. Yeah, it's a task. First one is you really have to commit to building this kind of relationship because it doesn't just fall together. I had a good quote on this one. Here it is. One author explained commitment like this. A successful marriage is not one in which two people, beautifully matched, find each other and get along happily ever after because of the initial matching. It is instead a system by means of which persons who are sinful and contentious? Who knew? The couples have this, the second quote down. System by which persons who are sinful and contentious are so caught by a dream bigger than themselves that they work throughout the years, in spite of repeated disappointment, to make the dream come true. Make it obvious to your mate that you're committed to making your marriage work. As long as I got this next one, I probably won't come back to it. It's an old proverb that says, the road to the heart is the ear. I believe it. That explains why many marriages are growing cold. When out of the 10,000 plus minutes every week, the average couple spends only 17 minutes in close communication. That's a chilling fact. I got an email from a friend of mine today who's asking for prayer for going to the hospital because he was experiencing hearing loss. He sent the follow-up saying, you know, went to the hospital, they said it's just normal loss of hearing, I've lost a couple tones. By the way, his wife, Lori, said, got glasses this week. They say the best marriages are made of husbands who are deaf and wives who are blind. So I guess we're destined to live happily ever after. All right. Now, part of this, you don't want to be totally blind in your relationship, but it's really good to overlook faults. And the second piece is going to address some of that. You have to choose. It's a choice you have to make. You have to choose to admire, accept, and appreciate God's perfect gift to you. It says in Proverbs 18, he who finds a wife finds a good thing, receives favor from the Lord, and a couple other verses like that. And a basic need of women is to be appreciated and cherished. And it's really easy to do that until you get married to them and they start doing things you don't like. But you have to make that choice to choose to do things. You have to, and for wives, it's really hard to admire this burping frog that you thought was a prince. But there are traits within them that are admirable, especially if they, the most admirable thing is a person who's chasing after God and righteousness and becoming like Jesus Christ. It's a choice to admire. It's a choice to accept. It's a choice to appreciate. And with the realization that God has provided this person not just for my needs as I perceive them, but for my needs as he perceives them, one of which happens to be my sanctification, then you begin to realize, you know, it's not really the other person or my spouse that's my problems. It's the fact that God has given me this spouse. Just like Adam said, the woman you gave me caused this problem. But the spouse that God has given us is actually designed by God for our benefit. One of the books I read before we got married and patterned some of my vows after, Jill as well. Actually, I saw her reading it first. This is before we were even dating. And the name of the book was Marriage Takes More Than Love. And I thought, just reading this book on marriage. This is promising. I wonder what this means. It's really a great book because they talk about, it's actually a hysterical book in some chapters, they talk about some of the issues that couples face. It's a good reality piece as to what actually works and what doesn't work in marriage. I still remember the first time where I was sitting when I read the chapter on communication. And you know, she's there trying to talk to him, and he's going, And she starts saying things like, "Well, I talked to the roofer today. We're going to put gold-plated clamshells on the roof." And the plumber stopped by, and we're running away to Hawaii next week. Yeah, she's doing all these outrageous things. He writes a chapter. She writes a chapter. And it's really well done. They wrote a second book, Beyond Marriage Takes More Than Love, called Opposites Attack. And the conventional wisdom is that opposites attract, and that does tend to be true. But then the follow-up to it is, once you have these opposites that have attracted to each other, then they attack each other. And they basically try to remake each other into their own image, and it lives unhappily ever after. So Jack and Carol Mayhall talk about the importance of adjusting yourself to your, you know, the needs and interests and abilities and capabilities of your spouse, just kind of like God does in dealing with us, accommodating yourself to your mate, like, you know, Jesus becoming a man to be able to interact with us. And then they even go so far as to say to affirm the differences, that those differences actually make the relationship vital and alive. As couples get older together, the differences diminish. I'm not sure if they become like each other. People who live together tend to become alike, so you know, those differences can diminish. But basic personality type differences never diminish. They're always going to be there. That's why the Myers-Briggs stuff is useful, to understand your mate and then appreciate and accept them. What follows underneath this is the normal pattern of a relationship. Some of it came out of mentalhealth.net. You get married with all these expectations, and those expectations getting dashed is, you know, the primary cause for getting rid of newlywed bliss. I thought it was going to be like this, and then I get disappointed. I get disillusioned. My Prince Charming is not so charming, nor is he a prince. And my beautiful princess is not a princess, nor is she that beautiful anymore. So there's disappointment. Now, how do you deal with the disappointment? Well, if you were looking to that person to meet all your needs and expectations and make you happy, you're going to be disappointed big time, because no other person can make you happy. That comes as a gift from God, according to Solomon. Your ability to find enjoyment in things is only given by God, so therefore you've got to make sure your ways please him. Major theme out of Ecclesiastes. But when you get disappointed, then the next thing that happens is there's fault finding. You know, it's a kind of a vindictiveness, you make me feel bad, so I'm going to make you feel bad and point out the things that you did that make me feel bad. And this starts escalating when it becomes a mutual fighting. That's going to lead to reduced love and attraction. You know, you're not going to, and I'm using love in the more secular sense, you're not going to be attracted to and enjoy this thing that's so flawed because you've just magnified all the flaws. So with this disillusionment, the next stage is erosion. The relationship now is just kind of disintegrating. You avoid each other, you get angry at each other, and the only way you can kind of exist is by not interacting or by carving out certain DMZ zones where you decide, okay, this is the space over which we can interact without either of us doing each other bodily or mental harm. And then you have a typical American marriage. The people have separated, physically, they might be in the same house, but by and large, there is no relationship. It's a basic pattern that relationships go through. So those of you who are single are probably thinking, it'll never happen to me. 6 out of 100, well, you're not going to be one of those 6 out of 100 unless something different goes on. Yeah, Brian?
What is the statistics within Christian circle? Is it very similar to this?
Yeah, before the 60s, the relationships in Christian circles used to be better, but now, I forget when it was, somewhere in the 90s that it kind of, they pulled up even, and it's because the world is in the church in the world, there's really not a whole lot of distinctiveness. People who are, born again, Bible reading, obeying, spirit, empowered believers would have better relationships, but the statistics don't necessarily rate people on those things. One statistic that I did see was that people in mainline churches have lower marital happiness and lower overall life happiness than people in non-denominational churches. And the difference between those churches, there are the mainline churches where they have guys who still believe and teach the Bible. But by and large, that would be the key difference between those two kinds of churches.
A mainline church?
One that's existed for a long time. No names, but you've got like your Presbyterian kind of churches and your Methodist kind of churches and your Baptist. Well, Baptists tend to be a little more in the non-denominational camp. But ones where it's or Anglican, Episcopalian, it's an organizational structure. Catholic would probably fit in there too. Where what they believe about the Bible isn't necessarily true. And, you'll find lots of people in these churches advocating divorce. And, obviously, that's not going to help build the marriages. Okay, so then there's separation. Here's a quote that actually came out of this one that I thought was really good. Remember, I don't totally... the mentalhealth.net is particularly the psych help book, is excellent. It will give you all kinds of research and all kinds of steps and all kinds of counseling paradigms and just this, it's a phenomenal resource. The guy put it up there for free. Just beware that, he would advocate divorce if it's, if you're one of those 50% that aren't going to make it unless you have some serious counseling, just go out and start with someone else. But he does say you need to change yourself, otherwise you're going to repeat the same mistakes. These people who have been married before have the least successful marriages. Just think about this. You think you'd learn from your mistakes when it's something as disastrous as that, but you think you'd be cautious going into a marriage if the first one caused so much heartache that you wind up ending the first one. It doesn't happen. The same person that got divorced is the same person that gets married again, therefore repeating the same mistakes. It is an unending task of true lovers to be sure the fun and affection outweigh the boredom and resentment. look at this from a Christian perspective. What's resentment doing in there? What's bitterness doing in there? Major satanic avenue for attack. Those things shouldn't be in the relationship. And boredom, if anyone is worshiping the God who made no two snowflakes alike, no two fingerprints alike, no two DNA codes alike, we worship a God of infinite variety. How does boredom set into a relationship? snowflake one really gets to me when I think of all the snow over all the world. I'm sure God could have said, okay, North Pole, boom, done. But he didn't. Each one has a unique structure. Okay, so you have to make these choices. And you only make these choices if you recognize that God is good and he only gives good gifts. Every good gift comes from above. Satan's major temptation to Adam and Eve was saying, God isn't good. He's withholding what's good from you. And I see people continually doubting God's goodness. Two people I spoke to who actively divorced their wives, the statement that they made in kind of the last chipper is, well, God wants me to be happy. And, didn't God want you to be happy when you married the first one? Oh, yeah, but that was wrong. That was a mistake. Oh, good. We're admitting a mistake. That's really good. Because admitting mistakes is the key to getting better relationships. Just think of your relationship with God. If you don't admit any mistakes, then you go to God and ask for forgiveness. And it works like that with humans. If you know how to relate to God, you can relate to others a whole lot easier. But they wouldn't buy that because they thought, well, the only way I'm going to get what's happy is if I go and do this thing. But if you choose that to accept, admire, and appreciate God's perfect gift to you as your spouse. I guess it might be good to just put a little blurb in here. One of the questions that always comes up, does God have just one perfect spouse for people? And Campus Crusade has a family life ministry run by Dennis Rainey out of Dallas Seminary. He's a Dallas Seminary grad. And the perspective on their ministry, and most people who do major marriage ministries, is that there's an ideal spouse. I'm sure there's a number that you could use to make the thing work, but there is an ideal spouse. And as I've grown and gotten to know and understand relationships with people more, you can kind of say how God really did pull those two people together. They really were uniquely suited to each other. And of course, obviously with Jill, I realized God knew what he was doing when the two of us get together. Sometimes I'm sure we both doubted that. Sometimes we still do doubt that. But anyway, it's another story. Okay, so you make this choice. These are all choices you have to make. And marriage takes more than love. You need to be aware of those choices. And these are the same kind of choices you can make in your covenant relationships. Okay, these are the people God put in my life. I need to learn how to relate to them. I need to learn how to have this open, honest, transparent relationship. Because if you think about it, marriage is about union. Okay? Now, it's all of you, all of another person, coming together. When we talk about intimacy, it happens on intellectual, social, spiritual, and emotional, as well as sexual levels. Everything comes together. Now, if you're hiding from yourself, hiding from God, hiding from others, do you think all of a sudden when you get into a relationship, that's going to change? Now there's just going to be more to hide. Winworth and Meyer, the guys who taught my counseling courses, said, and I've since seen the statistic unfortunately verified dozens of times, that we are blind to between 80 and 90% of our faults. So they actually statistically did this. They brought people in. They kind of did inventories with them about how they thought about themselves. And they go talk to their spouse, their kids, their co-workers. They've observed them. They observed them in other multiple settings. And they said, you're blind. Let's just do the 90% of your faults. That means for everything that you can say is not right about you, there are 9 things you don't see. Now, a lot of you are just going to brush that off because your self-image is so fragile you can't tolerate the fact that, oh no, there's something wrong with me. There can't be. That's just going to go over your head. But that is something you really need to think about. You're blind to your flaws. And those who live with you aren't.
Or what about the woman in the body?
I didn't say anything. it's a scary thought. So, I tend to adopt a more biblical view of believers as, saints, victorious kind of people. But for some areas of marriage, it's kind of good to realize, okay, we're just two sinners that God has pulled together. And we're going to work on not sinning so we can become those saints. and I'm sure there's a lot of stuff you have to forgive about me. There's a lot of stuff I need to forgive about you. Otherwise, you don't have a relationship. It was early in our relationship when Jill and I went to a Bill Gothard seminar, and one of the things that we practiced and saved us, neither of us came from a really good background, but the thing that saved us relating to each other was a statement, God has convicted me that I've sinned against him and you by doing X, Y, or Z. I've already asked God's forgiveness, and now I'm asking yours, will you forgive me? And that probably helped us avoid a lot of the submerged reefs that we could have encountered otherwise.
Question. Okay.
Yeah.
What does it mean to forgive?
Ah, what does it mean to forgive? Forgive does not mean forget, which a lot of people tend to think. But forgive, we're supposed to forgive as God has forgiven us. We're supposed to be tender-hearted, forgiving. It's Ephesians 4, maybe the first three or four verses. It's not there, it's in 5, the first couple verses. It's been one of those chapters. And how does God forgive us? Ooh, I got that right down there. There it is, under the R for remove, reduce, reduce sources of conflict. There it is. Forgive as you have been forgiven. Okay, how has God forgiven me? He's forgiven me graciously. He's forgiving me undeservedly. He's forgiving me permanently. Now, fellowship is another story. Forgive means I will no longer try to punish you for what you've done. I will no longer try to execute vengeance upon you for the way you did it. And
what does that mean?
Well, we're going to get there. Someone will say, whenever my wife and I fight, she gets historical. And the guy said, no, you mean hysterical. No, no, I mean historical. She always picks up everything I've ever done. Now, there's this thing between forgiveness and fellowship. And let's look at how God does it with us. God forgives us. Okay, God wipes the slate clean. Now, God also has this, he's omniscient, so he does remember these things. And he wants us to not engage in activity, behavior, thought patterns, whatever, that caused the relationship between us and him to break in the first part. Fellowship with God is dependent upon us doing things according to our agreement with God. And I would say, in part, fellowship with a spouse, even though you've forgiven them for whatever wrong they've done, is going to be dependent upon people committing to basically fulfill their marriage contract, whether they actually had one spelled out or they use the marriage contract that God has. So your ability to, you forgive someone, actually there's a whole outline on forgiveness. It's a big topic, so there's a good outline on it. To forgive someone, you have to recognize God has allowed this into my life. He's allowed this horrible thing to happen to me for my benefit. He also gives me all the grace I need to get through this in such a way that I get blessed. I had a guy from a work deal that just kind of, it was unbelievable some of the stuff that was going on. And I was starting to get bitter because I keep trying to forgive the guy, and the feelings of revenge and everything still came back until it kind of clicked that, okay, God gives me all I need to do his will. God's going to give me the grace to forgive this person. And then you look at the psalmist and he says, I really used to be bugged by the behavior and prosperity of the wicked until I went to the sanctuary and I considered their latter end. And you realize God is much, much better at paying back someone than I am. And then it starts evoking a feeling of pity for the person because, actually, God, I don't want you to hurt the person that much. But if God is infinitely just, he can pay back unbelievably better than I can. So forgive, it's you let go of the hurt, you ask God to heal you. I'm not doing the subject justice route, but it's how has God forgiven us? He has no desire for revenge or punishment. However, it doesn't mean that you're setting yourself up to be hurt again, because there's going to be this communication process that has to go on that prevents that from happening. So let me go through that, and if it's still, all of a sudden, I don't know if the outline's up there, but we have the outline on forgiveness up on the site. We'll get it up if it isn't, or I'll email it to you. In every relationship, there is conflict, okay? It's got to be. It just is inevitable. There's no perfect boss, perfect coworker, perfect kid, perfect parent, perfect spouse, perfect in-law, perfect outlaw. You know, it's just like this, none of that stuff. And Song of Solomon, written about how to have a great physically intimate relationship, has this little phrase about catching the little foxes. There are these little things that irritate the relationship. They ruin the vine so it never bears fruit. And these little irritations, as well as some of the really big obvious ones, prevent that kind of stuff from happening. So, I have three R's up there because they're all important. You want to resolve conflict. You want to remove the source of conflict. And if there's some stuff you can't remove, like a mother-in-law, you want to reduce the source of conflict. You know, it's like you want to do what it can to kind of make it so it's a lot more harmonious. Each of these is an individual task. Each of these is progressive. Some things can be resolved. You know, it's like, you know, do you like to sleep in on Saturday? I like to get up early on Saturday. You know, let's figure out how to resolve this in such a way so, you know, I don't wake you up when I get up. Removing the source of conflict. I read something that was in, okay, I sometimes look at the Ladies' Homes Journal on subjects of marriage, and it says, our dog ate our marriage. And it was a story about how this couple, after a year and a half, got a dog, and 6 months later, they wind up in the marriage counselor's office, all ready to get divorced because of the dog. They can't agree on, you know, where the dog sleeps, what he eats, how, you know, how walking him, and nothing that they can agree on with the dog. And obviously, the dog is just the lightning rod for all the other things that are wrong in their relationship. But it's a source of conflict that could have been removed from the relationship. I mean, they're getting divorced over the dog. But then if you start looking at it more closely, you begin to realize that they're doing a whole lots of things wrong. Okay, so first thing, we're going to spell conflict. I left out the I. I can't figure out if I just accidentally eliminated it or left out. I would probably do an imagine and a grain thing for the I piece in there, but correct behavior. You kind of reprogram your robot would be a piece that I think is missing from here, so that might be the original. Communicate over effect and cause. Gee, Bill, normally people say effect, cause and effect. Why did you say effect and cause? There's a huge amount of research backing a methodology of communicating, which is going to sound like it comes out of the 60s transactional analysis stuff, and it does, is to say, I feel hurt, sad, undervalued when you do or say blankety blank. Right? It's not, I hate it when you do that. Well, actually, I hate it when you do that would probably, that's not as good as I feel. These I feel statements. This is the effect that you are having on me. And the way this works in a mature relationship is you can be asking the question, and you might have to spell it out, do you really want to be having that effect on me? Because I feel this way when you do that. It takes a little strength, grace, power, and humility to admit that. But this is the effect you're having on me. I feel like this when you do or say that. And theoretically, if there are two people who are committed to obeying God and loving each other, they don't want that to happen. And there are two ways this thing can go. I could spend a whole day on this, and I won't. But way number one is stop doing why. Or, you know, I realize you feel X, but is that really the correct response? I don't intend that to be. And you don't want to actually say this outright, but where the thing goes is the programming is miswired. Experiences in their past have caused them to have this emotional response that when stimulus Y comes in, they engage in X behavior, even though they should have engaged in Z or A, B, and C. And there's been a miswiring. And the good news is, you can rewire your emotional responses. You can reprogram how you respond. In the old days, you just had to kind of pray and dwell on it, and more or less you would eventually hit upon the right strategy. Now, there's all kind of stuff where people have examined the neurophysiology of our brain, and you know, there's ways to reprogram even emotional responses. It's phenomenal. Of course, not everybody takes advantage of these things. So, to communicate. Communication is the key to your marriage. Having in common the way your behavior impacts another is key. And there are all kinds of books. Norman Wright wrote one of the first big marriage books out called Communication, the Key to Your Marriage. And people communicating is good. Trouble is, instead of communicating and having an understanding in common, people fight because they haven't done what the F thing down there on forgiving. You need to get out with the XX baggage, erroneous expectations, and self-centered slop. Let's do erroneous expectations. People go in expecting all kinds of wrong things. I thought it would be like this, and it's not. All right, it's not. Get used to it. Be real. Life doesn't work like that. Of course, you don't say it that way. and self-centered slop. You know, the self-centeredness is this dog story is unbelievable. The woman kind of comes home from working at her high-powered job at 8:30 or 9 at night. The husband has already eaten, and he's there working through his first six-pack of the evening. So sometimes he comes over and just sits there while she eats. Other times he just kind of snores on the couch. And she's thinking, something is missing in this relationship. So the counselor, wise man that he was, said, well, you know, tell me about how the two of you met. Well, he was pumping gas at the gas station. I thought he was really cute. He's really smart, but, you know, now he's going back to school. I mean, it's just like emotional glue attracted this relationship. I mean, there's this thing, but he's just being self-centered. He's dulling himself to the fact that he doesn't like his life. He's escaping. You know, anybody can polish up more than one six-pack at a night is obviously, you know, a couple sheets out of reality. Anyway, you need to get out of also the excess baggage. It's the stuff in italics, got the little star. Right down beneath it, there's another little star. Some woman wrote a book on emotional baggage, excess baggage. Things that they bring to the marriage besides their going away clothes. You know, it's like you get married and, you know, just imagine how this actually is. They've got their bags packed to go on their honeymoon. And then there are these trunks, and lots of trunks, and lots of trunks. And really, that's called the excess baggage that's coming along with them. It's the mother-in-law. It's the relationship with a previous boyfriend or girlfriend. It's all this other stuff that they haven't really matured as an individual, and they bring it along in the relationship, and obviously it ruins things. So this book, when it was written, kind of created a big stir, and it's true. These are some of the things: the need to be right, the need to feel superior, the dreading of rejection, the need to create drama and excitement in their life, so there'll be some fixing of it, and the cherishing of anger. You can kind of look it up, find the book, and just, you know,
maybe we should start a baggage presumption agreement.
Right. Okay. No hiding and hurling. One of the first conflicts shown interpersonally in the Bible is between Adam and Eve, when the sin had kind of caused a mess in the relationship. And Adam's first response is, the woman you gave me, she gave me to eat, and I took it. And they're hiding from the reality, hiding from each other. There's a book called The Trauma of Transparency. It's really a good one to read. It shows the two of them in their suits of armor with a wall built up between them, throwing bricks over the wall at each other. And that is kind of, you know, they get self-protective, build the walls of defense, and then hide from the other person and hurl things at them. Just think of the intimacy you have. If you're on two sides of a big wall, you built up between each other, and you're each in a suit of armor. Not. It ain't going to happen. So, but that's what people do. They hide and hurl. And normally because they've gotten so frustrated with the fact that the relationship has gotten to where it is, they think it's never can be fixed. The nice thing is God's hands are never so short he can't solve things. His grace is always sufficient. He gives you all you need to do his will. You just have to do it according to the manufacturer's directions. Just eventually coming. No hiding and hurling, so that means you don't say the things that you would say normally, and this leads to you forgive. If you forgive someone, and the bitterness forgiveness outlines kind of go into this a whole lot more depth. The requirement that God holds us to is to forgive as God forgives us. Otherwise, your Heavenly Father will not forgive you. It's the Lord's Prayer, right? Forgive us our debts or trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Now, that's obviously not talking about justification. Fellowship with God is dependent upon having good relationships with others. It's like, you know, remember, you can offer your gift and you remember your brother has something against you, or your spouse has something against you, leave your gift, come to God and get reconciled. So, This doesn't mean you have to, there's this concept called tough love. You don't have to just lay down and take abuse, but you do need to forgive so you're free of the bitterness, and then God's free to work on your spouse. Learn your lessons well, or you'll repeat them in a living hell. You have to, these lessons are not just things that happen once, they have to go over again. In terms of conflict, choose to compromise on what's right. That's not that hard. You know, if something's right, you kind of can meet each other where that point is. It's like not what one person wants or what the other person wants, but it's what's right. It's called principled negotiation. It's how, there's a book called Getting to Yes that deals with this. It's how superpowers negotiate. It's not about what one side wants or the other side wants, but they're appealing to a principle of what's right. This is where Christians have this huge benefit, is they always have some principles that God has given them to which they can both say, hey, it's not what you want or what I want. What does God say we should do here? And boom, you go up that triangle. You know, if you're here, your spouse is here, God's up there. The closer you are to God, the closer you are to each other. Except one person takes off, then it changes the dynamic of the relationship, because now the other person stays where they are and moves further away from God. The distance between the two increases. But if both people work on moving closer to God, they get closer to each other, and they have the same Christ-like mindset, the same approach to things. Spirit's at work in them. It actually is pretty easy to make things turn around. So that's to choose to compromise on what's right. Change yourself on what's left. So the stuff that's left over, you know, if you really want to love your spouse, give them a gift of changing. You know, guys have given up golf and other sports for their spouse and decided that it was a lot more fun with their spouse than, you know, trying to chase a ball in the woods somewhere. You know, really wasn't that much to give up to begin with. But most guys like golf because it keeps them out of the house and they don't have to interact with their family anymore. You know, it's a great thing. It's not too strenuous. You can do it for hours. And then, you know, then there's the 19th hole. You know, and then you come home and you don't care what happens. You know, it's like you're insulating yourself.
If she likes golfing, then there is a problem.
Oh, that is a problem, right? Then you take up... solitary bird watching. Shh, birds up here. Can't talk. Now, the problem is if you don't really love your mate, you don't want to change, and you kind of want to get back at him. That's why this, the forgiveness piece is kind of important. And then the thing to prevent these problems from arising, this is going to tie in nicely with the, I left off the I, which probably was the, out of the ink on a rain no more in toil, how do you get sanctified. Transform your filters, how you perceive stuff, your values, how you process stuff, your emotional responses, how you take that information that's come through your filters and hit your values and then bounced out. Self-talk and parental tapes, societal tapes and other tapes, all that stuff that's running around in your head that's in conflict with what God has said and it's not going to let you have a good relationship. Otherwise, you'll repeat those events as well. Sorry. Yeah, thank you, Jack. I was just trying to figure out if I should do this one or not. Dennis Rainey has written this book called Building Your Mate's Self-Esteem. Dennis and Barbara Rainey, I don't know if you've heard the story, kind of do Campus Crusade's family life ministry. And Dennis talks about all these years he loved his wife and cherished it, did everything he was supposed to. And the wife never responded. And her basic self-image of herself is that she was not sexually desirable. And it all goes back to a comment that another girl made to her in the sixth grade when she was flat-chested saying, oh, no guy's ever going to like you or something like that. All right? Now, in spite of the fact that she developed quite normally and that her husband was thrilled with her, she would not accept any of the things because she kept telling herself, oh, I'm undesirable. I can't accept this. Now, you know, here's Dennis trying to do his job as a husband and love and affirm and do all this other stuff. He's doing all the right stuff, but it's not working because of the tape that's going on in her brain. Can you see how that works? Contrary to reality. You know, everybody would look at Barbara and say, you know, clearly this is an attractive woman. Yet she wouldn't accept that. And that's why the self-talk, the tapes that go on in her heads, need to be brought out to God and say, God, is this true? What is true? And that's why a person needs to start getting their worth and value from God not from what a another person thinks, particularly a sixth grade girl who thinks. And things change, you know. She's no longer the woman she was in sixth grade.
Oh, yeah.
But she's still thinking of herself as what?
I think that some people are not very strong to get over it, you know. So everybody's always teasing you and saying, you know, because you're developing much slowly than other girls. And some people are not strong enough to get over it. Some people are. So.
Well, for the people who aren't strong enough to get over it, God's grace is more than adequate to change things. You can change the way you perceive yourself. This kind of goes back to the intimacy thing. I'm not going to get able to get into this amount of time. Is you basically get your worth and value from doing what pleases God, and then everything else falls into place. The spots where I'm not going to go now, I'll just do a couple questions because I realize, is the food here yet?
Yeah, it is here.
Okay. Is readily fulfilling your roles and responsibilities. We can talk about them some other time if you want. But just like anything works well when you follow the manufacturer's directions. If you follow them, it works. Being a liker, a lover rather than just a liker or a luster. Server of needs, his needs, her needs. The guy, psychologist out in San Francisco, noticed when people were breaking up that there were 10 things that felt were important in a relationship. The thing that he was astounded by is that the top 10 needs, the guy would rank them 1 to 10, the woman would rank them 1 to 10, and they were exact opposite. So the top needs for a guy were the lowest priority needs for a wife. And there's a whole book on it called His Needs, Her Needs. The book's decent, but the thing that's really great is just to understand that these are your spouse's needs. If the spouse will tell you their needs, here they are, and you can set apart yourself to working on them. Invest in intimacy on all levels. The next page does that. Align your attitudes and actions with Christ. If you really considered the other person as more important than yourself, you'd have a great relationship. One of the things that, despite our backgrounds, got Jill and me off to a great start, at least a better start than we would have had, is we were used to serving people without any thought of getting anything in return. We were ministering to college students. And when all of a sudden we get married and here's someone who's actually appreciative, it was great. It kind of overcame a lot of the stuff that we otherwise would have had to suffer through. Grow with godly goals. You need goals for your relationship. And the last one on accountability. When the Dillos were here, Jody made an aside to where he decided to settle down because someone said, hey, let's grow old together. There's another couple. And they decided to settle in that area so they could grow old with these folks. And then last but most important, expect to triumph through trials. Trials are necessary. They refine us. Trials are inevitable. God gives you the grace to get through the trials. All you have to do is have a relationship with God so you can draw upon that grace and then triumph through the trials. If you cherish the commitment, you can build a good relationship. If you don't cherish it, it's just like anything else. Anything you value, you can go after and get. You have to have two people to decide to agree on it. And God might make it that, you know, you get the point. Unfortunately, most people change when they're sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, it's only when it gets really bad do they decide to change. So those of you who knew the beginning of a relationship, avoid the pitfalls. Those of you who have kind of settled into one of the pits, you know, you can get out of those pits. Those of you who are contemplating this minefield of relationships, practice with those around you. That's what why God invented the body. If you do not have good relationships with those around you, you cannot live happily ever after. It is that simple. You know, it's just, I've read thousands of studies, and I've read the studies of 1,000 studies as well. That's the way it always works. Okay, questions? Yeah, please.
This may be too complicated to get into, but if you think about personality types, you might think, with people with the same personality type, the same background, and same, all that kind of same stuff, is somebody, one of my children should be looking for. But then when I look at Nissan, I mean, we're exact opposites on Myers-Briggs. Mm-hmm. And it presents its challenges, but I think it makes us more effective as a couple. So I'm trying to figure out, does it matter, or is that something you think about?
Yeah, there are books on that, and stuff that I read in terms of personality types and mate selection. I can kind of sum up from this perspective. It doesn't make a difference.
It does not.
It does not. It can make it easier or harder, So that, I guess, is a difference. But any kind of personality types can live together. There are benefits and disadvantages of almost every combination. If I had to pick an ideal kind of marriage relationship, a couple would be the same on introversion, extroversion, and they would have the opposite on NT, no, N and S, and they would be opposite on S and P. You need to have, J. You need to have one J in the relationship. Otherwise, your taxes don't get done, your bills don't get paid, your insurance lapses. I mean, it's really helpful in the relationship. To have a J. But if you have two people with the same need for external stimulation, frequently there's a problem when one person is an introvert, one person is an extrovert. They're just socially, that's always going to, you know, one person is always going to be accommodating themselves to the others. That can happen. God can take, arranged marriages actually have a higher level of success than ones where people pick their own spouses for two factors. One is the arranged marriage frequently comes out of a similar socioeconomic educational background, and that they have a greater degree of commonality, so they have less to fight over. And then secondly, they have external forces working and holding the relationship together. So that's kind of why those things work. But having people with those, you know, they're either both eyes or both E's, having one person see the big picture, the other person see the detail, is going to cause difficulties in the relationship, but then you're covered. You know, you're working as a team, you see all the pieces, and that's really, really useful. Having differing SJs is really good because it prevents you from making quick, bad decisions, but you make decisions when you kind of have to do it. And then on the TF things, it's really good to have at least one person be a T, so you have a level of objectivity. Because if you have two Fs living together and they're both feelers, you know, they feed off each other's distortion of reality and see something that is no longer there. You know, actually you could almost say a TF are good as a mix if they can learn to tolerate each other, because the Fs provide usually an impetus for stuff to make things happen. So
there's something in there.
It's good to know someone's feeling their worth is validated as a result of today.
So basically, arranged marriage is the way to go.
Now, actually, in a culture like ours, you kind of want, I think it's wise to have kids make their own decision, because you made the decision, now you have to live with it. You need to make it work. There's one less person to blame, and our culture is so good about looking to blame.
We should start arranging our kids right now. I have a beautiful daughter.
Yeah, Corey.
Okay.
Bring it next week.
For anybody interested?
If the theory is that there is one ideal spouse, then why in general is there so much? Why isn't it that people see this just in general? Is it just because people are just so short-sighted in getting their needs met that they're obviously, if you don't have God in the picture, it's not helping, but...
I wouldn't necessarily say it's just this one person. You have to go search through the haystack for it. Most of the I think, maybe I should probably learn how to phrase this so it really walks the tightrope. God has an ideal spouse for you, a spouse that is perfect for you, a spouse that there is no better than, I guess you'd say, you're just saying there's this one ideal person. I don't want to go so far as to say that, but I want to say that this person that God guides you to or guides to you as you are seeking his will is the best choice for you. The idea behind this is God's will is good, acceptable, and perfect. And you go into marriage with the understanding that this is God's will for me to be married to this person. Of course, you need to be obeying God's objective will before you determine his subjective will, and you have to be able to show why this is his subjective will. I heard a teen saying, oh, this relationship is definitely from God because we're exactly what the other person is looking for in a relationship. You know, these are little teens doing puppy love thing. Saying, well, I'm looking for puppy love, and you're looking for puppy love, so this must be it. Woof, woof. You know, so it's just... So, the unrequited love... Oh, I don't know. Anybody have a good answer to that one?
I think you answered it.
All right, thanks. Brian.
You're done with that.
Sure, yes.
Sorry.
If I can find one person to affirm me, yep, done.
How do you know if you're getting your needs met in a bad way? Like, I'm wondering if two people come into a relationship and they're getting their needs met through God, and then one slowly starts to... Is there a possibility that one can slowly start to get their needs met through the other person?
Oh, yeah.
And then does conflict come about then, or...
Okay, conflict is a sign that something's not right.
Repeated conflict?
Well, if you're conflicting over the same issue again and again.
Right.
All right, so if any conflict you want to look at, well, what caused it? I mean, just think about this. This is a thorn, so let's, you know, especially if I keep banging into this thorn, I need to do something about that thorn. So what causes it? And normally those kind, you know, you start thinking about what caused it is, I was disappointed. Why was I disappointed? Because my expectations weren't met. Okay, were my expectations legitimate? No, my expectations were not legitimate. Okay, that's a need that, you know, God's supposed to meet, and it's not legitimate for me to expect my spouse to be able to do that. Or, yes, my expectation was legitimate. Just like a flowchart, you kind of work your way through. You engineer types should like this. And then you say, okay, it was legitimate, but my spouse is not meeting my need. Okay, now, how do I respond to my legitimate needs not being met? Is God able to meet that need? Yeah. Okay, there it is. I'm looking to that spouse for meeting my needs when I should be looking to God first. And if I get bent out of shape over my needs not being met by my spouse, then I can conclude that God is not meeting my need, and I need to work on that. Once I am content with the situation and I am content with it not being met, then I am freed of the anger, hostility, bitterness, and vengefulness, and all those other things that are going to hamper communication. And then I can talk to my spouse about it and then say, you know, it would... You know, if you loved me, no, I don't want to say that, but, you know, it would be in the interest of a more harmonious relationship if this would happen. Is there anything I'm doing that makes it difficult for this to happen? So, you know, when there's a conflict, that's probably the warning light's going off. Yeah, Brenda.
When you get married with the bad objectives, you can still work through, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
So if you, through learning how to do the... But change the views into the better objective.
Right. If any man's in Christ, he's a new creature. Old things have passed away. All things are becoming new. God specializes in taking things that are broken and making them better than they, you know, could have, were originally. You know, so he takes, just think individually, he takes lives and he makes them better than they were before. Unfortunately, we won't come to him until the life usually is broken. Same thing with relationships. He takes bad relationships and makes them into great relationships. Well, I had a Greek professor that was really this big fan of this thing called Christian Marriage Encounter, and he kind of kept nudging, and, you know, finally a number of his students went on one of these things. And I thought it was a little dorky, but it was basically people sharing letters that they had written to each other, expressing how they felt, and they would write letters and they'd read them to each other. And, you know, it's not one of the more exciting conferences I've ever been to, but it was actually somewhat mildly beneficial, I thought, for our relationship, because we had talked about stuff like this. But as I listened to the letters, I realized how bad these situations had been, and a lot of people in their letters were talking, you know, they'd sit there and read their letters that they wrote to their spouse, and, you know, God took really bad relationships and made them really good. So they went into it with all the wrong reasons, had all the crashes that you'd expect from something not functioning correctly, and then it's a little harder to learn how to develop new patterns of relationships, new patterns of relating, new patterns of responding. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's doable. And with God's grace, anything's doable. And if it's God's will, of course it's going to happen. So the only spot where there's a shortage is, I just don't want to believe that God's good and wants what's good for me.
So what would, like, well, how would you define to deal the best way with getting angry that the prince is not there anymore and he was stuck with the frog?
Okay. I think communication would be a good start. You know what? This actually, I did a thing on anger. Steve Minn, I think, did another sermon on anger. So there's some good resources in the anger thing. But anger is going to be too big a deal to get into. Anger comes because our rights have been, we perceive that our rights have been violated. You go back to last week. You yield your rights. You recognize that God in His sovereignty has allowed this situation for my best interest. Okay, God, how do you want to bless me in this situation? And God says, well, the first thing I want to bless you with is by helping you realize that the world does not revolve around you getting your needs met. The world really revolves around God. You know, so God uses things not working to get our attention. It's just real, real simple. You know, if you have reaped radishes, you've been sowing radishes. So God uses the anger that you have from the fact that you got radishes to say, oh, no, I've been planting radishes, you know? And, you know, it's just, this is a long thing that goes on to that, but you're not there yet. So hypothetically, if this ever situation arises, we can talk more about it. Yeah, Your Honor?
It sounds like it seems pretty difficult in a marriage. And also, if my niece can be met by God, why does someone else get married?
Oh, great question.
And also from the Bible, does God have no opinion
on
marriage? Does He want people to get married, or He's neutral on that?
Okay. God did say, after Adam named all the animals, it's not good for man to be alone. I will make a helper, a companion, someone tailor-made, suitable for him. And God saw that it was good, all right? So it's not good for man to be alone. I mean, the species doesn't continue unless people do get married and, you know, reproduce. Paul does say in 1 Corinthians 7, I believe it starts, that it's actually better to be single. Now, the Catholic Church has taken this and said marriage is second-class citizens. You know, so if you get married, you're a second-class citizen. The higher role is to become a nun or a monk. But then when you start using that, you know, revelation, reason, reality paradigm, you realize that can't be the case because the species doesn't continue to exist. And marriage affords people the opportunity to reflect the unity, love, and wisdom of God. It's a good thing. So I would say God is basically neutral on it. And the key for a person is to get to a neutral point where they say, okay, God, whatever you want, you know what's best. Because when you get to that point where, you know, you leave the decisions up to God, God always gives the very best. When we go and, you know, hold on to something, we think, oh, that's going to be good, then, you know, God has to kind of work on prying our fingers off it. That hurts. You know, and finally, you know, we begrudgingly let go, and then, you know, we're in no shape for Him to give us something better. So you need to get to the point. There's a thing I did on Lord of the Ringless. It's contentment. This is a sermon that whole, I did it, like, in the past year. Totally addresses that whole idea of being content without the ring. There it is. And then God is free to do it, provide what's best. And God will provide what's best, and for some people, best might be being single. For other people, best might be being married. And I, you know, I'm glad you picked up on the fact that marriage can be less than ideal, because everybody thinks who's single, oh, I only got married, all my problems will be multiplied. No, they don't think that. But that is really what happens. Yeah, Brian, you know?
Well, no, I was just going to say real quick. My
one of my family members has been struggling with, well, that person is with another got a boyfriend, and I've tried to talk to her about bringing your knees before God, but I think it's the toughest thing. And even when I remember when I was single, of getting you're actually, especially with feelers, it's tricky, or it's a very tough thing to get your feel like you're getting your needs met, and you're actually feeling that inside.
I think you're extroverted too.
Yeah.
It is. I'm not saying it's very easy, but people who've gone through the outline on had to get your emotional needs met by God, feelers who have gone through that have come out and say, wow, God is so cool. Because part of what it is I went through the Psalms and I took Dave's entire emotional life, this big book, God's concerned about this stuff, and showed how God met those needs in David's life. And God does meet those needs if you allow him to. And an intimacy thing, I kind of have part of it bolded. There's a lot more to it, but it's another outline. Okay, if Poot's here, we might pick up this topic somewhere in the future, or we might not. I think Easter's next week, so I'll probably do something Eastery. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Let's pray. Father, we humbly bow before you, acknowledging that you are the God who is all-knowing, all-wise, all-good, all-powerful. The God who designed life, the God who designed marriage, the God who knows how everything works, the God who's planned things for us that are really good. Father, I pray that you would give us the desire and the motivation to trust you for what's best, regardless of whether we are single or married. I pray that you would give us the desire to follow you in such a way that we get transformed and we can experience your best, again, single or married. Pray for the marriages, that you would strengthen them, help couples really cause their marriages to shine as they reflect and experience your love and share your love with each other. I pray for the singles, that you would guard them from any of Satan's lies and deceptions. And I pray for us as a body, that our relationships with each other would reflect the love that you have for us. Cause us to interact and relate in such a way that you are pleased and glorified. Thanks for food. Pray you bless your fellowship in Christ's name. Amen.